Good morning, agus fáilteas teach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm really delighted to be welcoming someone who is well known in the Irish New York community and in journalistic circles in particular. I'm speaking about the award-winning Irish-American journalist, author, broadcaster and Irish Echo editor Ray O'Hanlon. As you will find out in this wonderful conversation between myself and Ray, the book he is talking about, his book called Unintended Consequences, The Story of Irish Immigration to the U.S. and How America's Door Was Closed to the Irish, is a culmination of actually a lifetime of engagement with Irish America as an immigrant to the United States and an observer of Irish America and the transatlantic space between the United States and Ireland. I actually can't think of anyone more qualified than Ray to pen such a great, interesting and important read, and a book that really adds flesh to the bones in terms of policy decisions and political decisions that have real life consequences. Ray's a wonderful writer and he's a very astute observer of things. That's why he's such a successful journalist and broadcaster. And in Unintended Consequences, he humanizes and I suppose gives us some interesting historical human context to decisions and history and policy that would have real life consequences. Unintended Consequences came out in 2021. It was published by our great friends at Irish Academic Press, Merrion Press, Conor Graham and his team there. I'm sorry that it's actually taken me longer than I would like to have caught Ray for this conversation. We should have done this sooner, but better late than never, as we say. And now that we're all back refreshed after our lovely long summer, I can think of no better way to kick off our fall programs of This Irish American Life than a conversation around this really important book. Anyone who's interested in the story of Irish immigration to the US, anyone who's interested in US immigration policy, and really provides food for thought for us around a whole raft of issues in terms of the positioning of Irish America, the demographic impact of these kinds of changes, and as we look to the future, as we look to the Ireland of today, I mean, it really is a very, very interesting intervention into the field. I've really enjoyed dipping into this and engaging. Ray breaks it down into a long list of individual chapters. I really like, he's about 50, you know, short chapters. It makes it really nice and easy to read, which weaves through some of these. This is not easy to do, and as I said, it's not, historians, we come at these kinds of topics in a certain way, and I suppose journalists or commentators commenting on the now come at it in a certain way as well. What Ray does really nicely in Unintended Consequences is to kind of bring those two disciplines or approaches together, so it's readable but is also very firmly laying out the context and impact of these changes and how they would reverberate over time. So it's always a great pleasure to talk to Ray. He is someone who has spent a long time in the United States, and because of his work and because of his general disposition, I think, has been on the sidelines of some of the ups and downs of Irish immigration in the United States over a number of decades. So for no other reason beyond that, and for so many more because it's a great read, I'm really delighted to have an opportunity to showcase Unintended Consequences today. And as I said, it really is a nice way to kick off our fall 2022 programs of This Irish American Life. So thanks for tuning in, folks. It's always great to have you on board here, and I'm going to transition now into that chat with Ray. On this week's This Irish American Life, I am delighted to welcome Ray O'Hanlon. Many of you will know Ray wearing his Irish Echo, prominent Irish journalism hat in the US for many decades. But my reason and excuse, and it's always a great one to have a chat with Ray today, is to discuss his book, Unintended Consequences, The Story of Irish Immigration to the US and How America's Door Was Closed to the Irish. It was published in April of 2021 by our great friends at Irish Academic Press. And I suppose in the interest of full disclosure, I should say, Ray, congratulations again. And this is a project that I've had the privilege of knowing about for quite a while as you were working on it. It was a project that you dedicated yourself to over a number of years, from what I can gather. It's an aspect of the nexus or that network of policy decisions and political decisions and redrawings of maps in literal and figurative ways that has been little written about until you stepped up on this one, Ray. Can you tell us about the genesis of Unintended Consequences and how you got interested in the topic? It's a personal story, I guess, from that perspective.
Yeah, the genesis, you could say the genesis of it, the very beginning of it, was the very first day that I landed in America on a permanent basis. I first came to the United States in 1982 to California to stay with friends for a number of weeks in the middle of the Irish winter, and I was hard put to go back. I returned in 1983. I was going to a wedding in Columbus, Ohio, and it was on that trip that I was introduced to my future wife, Lisa, by a mutual Irish friend in the White Horse Tavern in Manhattan. And Lisa was a teacher and had been a student in Ireland over the years. She actually studied at UCD and in Queens and Belfast, so she was very familiar with Ireland, but she's from Chicago. She and I met and kept in touch. I was back in 1986, and then I used to work for the Irish Press newspaper in Dublin at the time, and as our relationship developed, I realized that I was going to have to sort of make a move, really, away from home, away from the mammy and daddy and all that, and see how it worked out over in the United States. And I arrived on that April day. You always, an immigrant always remembers date, the weather, and certain other things of that first day. And I had leave of absence from the Irish Press for 4 months. I'd wanted a year, and they said, look, no Irish engagements here. You make up your mind, gonna marry this girl, we're giving you 4 months, which in retrospect was actually quite generous. And, but it made me sort of get my act together. So I ended up staying here. I've been here for now for over half my life. Half of my life is in Ireland. Half of my life is in America. So I suppose I feel I'm in a position to sort of pronounce on both. And in terms of the immigration issue, I was very lucky myself because obviously I didn't get a fiancé visa at the time. I had an I visa, journalist visa, which I didn't have to worry about looking over my shoulder. But I very quickly became aware of the fact that many, many of my fellow Irish men and women in those late 1980s were looking over their shoulder in America, and for reasons that I would explore as a reporter, initially for the Irish press. I wasn't working for an Irish-American publication. I had said to the press, look, if I'm in New York, things go on in New York. You want stories? And they said, absolutely. And I started to write stories, which I was allowed to do under my I visa. It was the only work I could do, in fact. And I started working. I think I did more work stories for them here from New York than I ever did in Dublin. And one of them was immigration. And the earliest memory I have of an immigration story was sitting on a bed in an apartment in Brooklyn Heights, talking to a congressman named Roman Mazzoli. You might think, oh, well, he was only just down the road in Brooklyn with a name like that, but he actually represented a district in Kentucky. But Mazzoli was in the front lines in the House of Representatives at the time in efforts to forge a comprehensive immigration reform bill, because it wasn't just the Irish who were coming here at the time, but there was a lot of people starting to come in from various countries, and there was no means of accommodating them legally. And obviously in the case of the Irish, the fact that they were facing this sort of situation where, unlike their forebears, they could not sort of look forward to a legal life. They didn't stay quiet. As you know, we Irish don't stay quiet. And, so the clamor for change began to rise at that time. And, I was aware of the formation of the Irish immigration reform movement. And of course, once they were on the scene, things began to certainly happen.
And you open up your preface very nicely of the book, Ray, by contextualizing your own kind of biographical narrative a little bit in that way. Mm-hmm. And you open the book again, and it's interesting that you mentioned that congressman. The opening chapter of the book draws on someone who's now one of the most prominent American politicians and someone who's been kind of on the circuit in terms of some of these discussions around immigration reform, and has been, from what I've observed, quite connected to the Irish community, Chuck Schumer. Can you tell us a little bit about...
I mean, you mentioned the opening chapter. When I was, I started to write this book, a number of years ago. As you know, there's lots of distractions in this world, and work and kids and family and everything else. But I could write a book about immigration, and I could do a general introduction on the Irish and immigration and everything else. But I think it was the news reporter in me that said, no, the opening chapter is an event, a scene, a setting, a stage, a drama, if you will. Take the reader right into the middle of something and then try to explain why was this happening. I think that's the very first line in the chapter, why were they all here? Mm-hmm. And I remember that extraordinary night on McLean Avenue at St. Barnabas Church Hall. It was the beginning of December, and the place was packed. And they weren't all Irish in the room either. There were others, they knew Schumer and the situation and everything else, and you could strike a match in the atmosphere in that room. And it was an extraordinary night, because very oddly for the beginning of December, there was this massive weather front went through, and there was thunder and lightning, and there were reports of mini tornadoes and waterspouts. It was like Tornado Alley in Kansas or something. So it was, as I think I may have mentioned in the chapters, it was almost a Shakespearean thing. So this rather dramatic opening is this sort of introduction to a story that is both dramatic, but also lengthy and detailed. And I suppose at times when you're talking about politics and debate over immigration, can kind of you might sort of think, oh my God, I'm going to nod off here, you know, sort of. But I decided that you had to, if you're going to pull the reader in, you've got to present them with something that is abnormal, unusual, or as Charlie Hawley might have said way back in the day, grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre, or whatever it was, goo-goo. Mm-hmm. And it is that. And that was not the only night on McLean Avenue or the only event over the years, but certainly it was one of the most dramatic ones I can remember.
From that opening chapter, you kind of go back to, in a way, set out the context of the significance of the 1960s. And I suppose, not to belabor it, but this is, you know, kind of relevant to the great narratives of the Irish-American experience and everything, to kind of mention the context of the Kennedys and the election of JFK, the first Catholic president of the United mm-hmm. States, strong Irish background, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the Kennedy, the connection with the Kennedys and Ted Kennedy later is very much part and parcel of your exploration of all these themes and everything. And I suppose, I think what you're kind of getting at in that chapter, Ray, if I'm not misunderstanding, is a kind of a sense of irony in a way, the fact that on one level, you know, the Irish are kind of seem to have arrived a little bit in the American experience, one could say, but at mm-hmm. that very time, demographically, these changes are taking place, which will have long-term consequences. Am I understanding you correctly there? And maybe,
yeah, no, I
not,
think you,
if
you,
not, you, you elucidated a little bit better.
Yeah. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. There's a colossal irony here that seemingly at the peak, and you're going back to the 1960s, sort of Irish America's reached a kind of a summit, a Mount Everest, if you will. And at that very moment, the door was closing and was closed on the Irish. It's only possibly with the benefit of the passing of the years and we look back at it. Some people are in the middle of the time real. Certainly must have seen the irony of it. Those who saw the 65 Act as possibly an end of a great story. You know, for me, you know, because I came here in the 1980s and I'd written about the Irish immigration reform movement over the years, and when I joined the Irish Echo, obviously they became almost meat and potatoes each and every week. And in those days it was each and every week because it was print issue only. Today it's every day because of online. But so I was very acutely aware and knew all the players, the main players in the IIRM and what they were trying to do. So I was in the middle of that story, and as you're aware, towards the end of the 1990s, I did write a book called The New Irish Americans, which looked very closely at all the work. A lot of that book was, half that book really was to do with immigration. There was a politics and Clinton and all sorts of other stuff and cultural stuff, but the basis of it really was immigration and the work of the IIRM. And I'd been witness to this. So that was like, almost like, okay, I've been here 10 years. What has happened? What have I seen? And that book sort of describes that. And then in later years, obviously as the years pass by and no fundamental changes occur, and then you have the arrival of the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform, and they made a sort of a great demonstration of the issue very dramatically down. And you had former IIRM members in it down in Washington, D.C. and stuff like that, with rallies and everything else. So here we were with another group. And then, you know, move on a few years, Judge John Collins makes available his memoir, his papers. This was something that I was really only vaguely aware of, that I, you know, obviously I knew about IIRM, ILIR, and all of a sudden, here we have this other organization, the American Irish National Immigration Committee from the 1960s, who are doing the same thing. We're in the thick of things mm-hmm. post the 65 Act. And battling away in Congress and attending hearings and sending people up and down to Washington and arguing that this was the end of the story for the Irish in America, and meeting a kind of a wall of, well, no, skepticism and indifference. Absolutely not. Because when the 65 Act was signed on Liberty Island on October 3rd, 1965, the view of official Washington of Irish American, most Irish American politicians, and it was that nothing's really going to change. a national quota system will go, but the same people will make the journey across the Atlantic. And if there's fewer Irish coming, that's okay, because it's the reason being is that Ireland is now finally developing economically. And, you know, really, don't worry, boys and girls, it ain't going to be that different. But of course, it was completely different. Hence the unintended consequences. You could also call it unseen consequences as well, I suppose. I mean, you have the cover of the book, and you have that sort of iconic photograph of President Lyndon Johnson signing the 65 Immigration Nationality Act on a table in on Liberty Island on that October day. And to his left, you see Teddy Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. I believe just off the right of the photograph, she's partly obscured, is Jackie Kennedy. And you see all sorts of other members of, you see Avril Harriman in the background, the great presidential advisor. I think Mayor Lindsay, all sorts of the great and the good witnessing this groundbreaking change in American immigration policy that was very much in the spirit of the times, very much sort of a cousin of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and other things like that. It was meant to make immigration more equitable. And that was a noble idea, but what it really did was just, it was a bit like a seesaw. So instead of the seesaw being balanced somewhere in the middle, and you would have more people coming from other parts of the world, the Caribbean, Africa, Asia, South America, as should have been the case, but also still Europe, also still Ireland, you would sort of have an equal flow from in proportion to population from all these countries. But it became like a, you know, on the one hand, you had, before that, you had the national quota system, and the seesaw was down on one side. And the result ultimately was that the seesaw went down on the other side. So when you write a book, you know, you sort of think, am I arguing a point here? Is there a core point that I'm making here? Do I have a line in the sand? Do I have a philosophical and political line in the sand here? And I sort of decided that, in a way, I can't argue with the 65 Act, what it was meant to do, what its philosophy is. I can see the merits in it. But from a point of view of Ireland and the Irish, I think everybody would agree that nobody ever wanted or wants to see again forced mass migration from Ireland ever again, where Irish people feel they have no choice. We don't want to see that again. So that's part one of where, what's the philosophical, political bottom line. But at the same time, I sort of think, well, yeah, right, that's okay. But neither do you want to see a situation where, let's say a young Irish man or a young Irish woman wake up in their bed on Monday morning and say, look, I've done this, this, and this, and I think I can do this, this, and this very well in America. I'd like to give my life a go in America. And that they've been denied this opportunity and chance simply because they woke up in an Irish bed. Mm. You know, you don't want that either. And that's the situation as it is. It's virtually impossible. I wrote a story recently, and you may have seen it. The numbers came out for the latest batch of diversity visas, 55,000 visas a year distributed around the world. There were 17 Irish visas out of the 55,000. 17. And that's
the whole island, isn't it, Ray?
That's the whole island, because yeah. Northern Ireland was included in the diversity visa program as well. It was separated from Britain in that regard. So you're talking about the entire island of Ireland. 17, the headline was The Magnificent 17, was an obvious play on The Magnificent Seven. Mm-hmm. And I sort of made the point at the beginning that a few years ago, the Irish would, or on the immigration front lines, would complain that there was maybe only a couple of hundred Irish getting diversity visas. And I said, well, God, that's just a few years ago, but although already those years look golden, because now we're down to teens.
Yeah. You know?
And that happened in 1968. I think it's mentioned in the book, because the 65 Act took 3 years to come into full force. So it didn't actually fully apply until 1968. And when it did, when it kicked in, it was the month of July, and the number of visa applications at the American Embassy in Dublin, I don't know what, it fell to precisely zero. Irish immigration went over a cliff in 1968. And I suppose here we are in 2022 when you're talking about 17 diversity visas. Now there's a few Irish get in under HB, this and that, you know, various other things and marriage or whatever. So there's more Irish coming than that. But this is the primary access, regular visa, nothing to do, you know, I don't have to be an atomic physicist to get in kind of visa. Mm-hmm. This is it, the diversity visa. And you're talking about teens, 17. This is a second, this is another cliff. This is like 68 again. This number just emphasizes the fact that Irish immigration is, as I say, you don't want, it doesn't, it really shouldn't come down to numbers. I mean, because you don't want thousands coming here because, you know, they want a life primarily in Ireland first, but there are some who would definitely do well here or want to do well here, and they simply can't come here. So that's the situation where there has to be some change.
Yeah, I don't know whether, Ray, I ever told you, I won one of the diversity visas.
Oh, God bless you.
I think I must have got mine in, I think I won it in 2006. And I think that year, I remember May O'Driscoll asking me, because, you know, May would be someone who'd be interested in these things because of some of her work. And I think she told me, and I must look back up those figures, about 200 or 250 were issued that year.
Mm.
Like you, you know, it kind of, it changed my life in ways, in, but kind of like you, I probably could have attained a visa through other pathways. I like how you conceptualize that, Ray, in terms of like the, not the pendulum, the seesaw, and it going so far in the other direction and what the implications of that can be, you know. And you and I are very attuned on a kind of community and cultural level, what that can mean in terms of that long tradition in the Irish American community of kind of new blood coming over from Ireland and, mm-hmm. you know, injecting new things into the community in different ways, you know, that kind of way. Like that's been good. That was basically going on for the last 150 odd years or so. And I suppose the unhappy coincidence, or just, and in ways, the way you frame it again, because some of it is positive from, you know, my knowledge of, you know, Irish demographics in Ireland and economic history and things like this. These decisions and the impacts of these policy changes are actually taking place in an Ireland where there is economic optimism and prosperity and things like that. So the immediate impact of what these, this, you know, kind of changes would make weren't apparent right away. Is that right, Ray? Am I correct in seeing it that way? And it's that there are. And I've had the good fortune and privilege of interviewing John Collins as well. And that sense of kind of there being this small cohort of people almost kind of, you know, saying, you know, hold on a second, guys. You know what I mean? That they're in the wilderness kind of saying, you know, this is going to be catastrophic in ways.
You always have, it's a bit like talking about climate change. You can see the winds of change. You can see what's coming. You have to really jump up and down and shout, because most people are just getting on with their lives and don't really want to know. Got enough problems as is, you know. So, I mean, I think back in 68, when America itself was so distracted with so many things, I mean, it was a tumultuous time in American history, not least due to the Vietnam War. If you were jumping up and down and flapping your arms and say, look, this is going to cause a problem for the Irish coming to America, some people would probably say to you, well, yeah, that's fine, but my God, we've got bigger issues and problems to deal with here. So it was a very distracted time in that regard. So it was a relatively small number of people who were sort of drawing attention to this fundamental change. If you think of the Irish in retrospect, it's no small thing. When you're talking about the second largest ethnic group in America, that's the Germans. And what the Irish have done and contributed to the building of America. Those Irish Americans at the time in the 1960s had every right to point out that it's not that they had a divine right or something like that, but they had some right to be heard and argue that something needs to be, you need to look at this more closely, that the changes could be quite fundamental for this community. But I mean, I suppose you could also argue that there was also the seeds in the time of the prosperity of Ireland today, because you were beginning to see, as I said earlier, economic development and plans for economic development in Ireland. And then you look at the Ireland of today, it is absolutely unrecognizable from that time. It is unrecognizable from the 1980s. And the 1980s obviously stand out as a time, as I remember trying to explain in stories here, that one of the reasons that so many young Irish just packed their bags and headed for Boston and New York and elsewhere at the time was it was a generation raised to higher expectations. The world was changing and they were aware of it. They could see that world and through media, through TV at the time and everything else, they were being raised to higher expectations in Ireland itself. And much of the 1980s was a recession in Ireland. So those expectations were being dashed. So they said, enough of this. We're making for the hills. We're heading west. And a lot went to England as well and some to Australia and whatever. But as we know, tens of thousands made the journey westward across the Atlantic and landed here a lot of the time with connections, because the connections were still strong at the time. You get this, the young guy in County Mayo get a call from the cousin in the Bronx saying, look, come on over, no problem, work, yeah, absolutely, guaranteed, come on, get your place to stay. That sort of connection was still there. It still is to some extent, but not nearly as much as it was in those days. But we have, in 2022, we have a radically different America and a radically different Ireland. And I suppose you could argue they don't fit as well together as they used to for various reasons. But at the same time, I think I go back to what I was saying about the young man, young woman waking up on a Monday morning, being denied simply because of where they're waking up. And my gut tells me, you know, there's something wrong with that.
You have a chapter in the book, and he's a central kind of personality to your story in many ways. And again, it's the Kennedy connection. You've a chapter 5 is called Teddy. I want people to read this book because it's a great read, and it's a really important insight, kind of intervention into the historiography on 20th century migration patterns and policy decisions on the American side vis-a-vis Ireland, et cetera, et cetera. But can you locate Teddy Kennedy a little bit in your story more generally, Ray?
Absolutely. Teddy Kennedy was there at the beginning, there in the middle, there at the end of his life. He was absolutely, I mean, there is a bit where Kennedy was interviewed by the Miller Institute of the University of Virginia, and he got into the immigration thing. And Teddy didn't seem to remember that he was on Liberty Island that day in October 63. I reached this point that this is a very stark contrast, because he's saying he wasn't there, and there he is in the photograph. And I said, I'll be kind to Teddy here. Teddy must have been in countless places over the years, at countless events. I mean, his life, talk about jam-packed. I mean, I can't remember half the things I was at 30, 40 years ago. So I let him off the hook in that he was there and he's in the photograph. And he believed, I think, at the time that, you know, this was good for America, this new way of looking at immigration. And B, it wouldn't be bad for Ireland. And I know the way Teddy would think, that if something untoward does come up, we'll do something. We'll look after the Irish. That came up again in the IRM years with Brian Donnelly and the scene, I think I repeated in this book, where the Donnelly visas are going through and Tip O'Neill calls Brian Donnelly up to the speaker's podium and says, look, I have to look really pissed off at you. I'm going to really glare at you and look like I'm really angry with you as you go back to your desk, to your chair. But don't worry, we'll look after the Irish. I have to believe that in Teddy's mind, that was always there, that belief that if worst comes to the worst, we'll look after the Irish. And he did, and he worked morning, noon, and night in later years to try and make that happen. When it became plain that the Irish were completely shut out, Teddy was to the fore in all manner of efforts on Capitol Hill to bring forth comprehensive immigration reform that would include the Irish and various things. So I'm not sure if he felt guilty when he looked back or just felt that was what it was and now something should be done. But he is there. Teddy is there in the 60s. He's there in the 70s. He's there in the 80s. He's there in the 90s. And he's there in the first decade of this century. You're talking about half a century in which Senator Edward Kennedy is at the very core of this story. And I believe he absolutely meant the best for the Irish. He was very sentimental about the Irish. The Irish get sentimental about Kennedys. The Kennedys are very sentimental about the Irish. Yeah, I met Teddy a few times over the years, and there was no doubt that where his heart lay, and he was a very skilled political operator in Washington. But he was up against forces, not so much, anti-Irish or anything like that, but of inertia and growing hostility towards immigration in its absolute general sense. You know, immigration from anywhere, all over the world. And we saw that reach its peak during the Trump years, where forget it. So Teddy is I suppose he could be a kind of a Shakespearean figure. I don't know. Is he tragic? Is he heroic? Is he a bit of both? I think he's a bit of both. But he's essential to this story. This story doesn't really gel. It doesn't really work. He's a bind. He pulls it all together in many ways. The fact that he was there for so long. He is the sine qua non of the story, I think.
Ray, you combine, there's a lot of history in this book. Can I ask you a little bit about how you wrote this and how you write in generally? But just before we maybe go into that, the research component of it, because, you know, you draw on a lot of historical examples and things like that. I know some of it you have probably picked up down through the years because of your interest and your profession as a journalism and commentator on Irish America in particular. But were there any particular kind of research approaches or archives or ways in for you to make real, so that you make real to the reader in such a great way, the kind of historical precedents or kind of connections that you bring into unintended consequences?
Well, it was a combination. There's obviously a bunch of books I've read over the years, some of them are mentioned, I think, in the bibliography. There was my own work for the Irish Echo. And then the Irish Echo archives themselves went back to the 1960s, because the Echo's been around since 1928. The Echo reported on the 65 Act. That was pivotal. And then, of course, Judge Collins' own sort of memoir on what happened then was just fundamental. That is a big chunk of the book in that. Historical context is important. There's two chapters in the book that I believe why is it such a big deal with the Irish in America? Well, what's going on here? Well, why is this so important? What are the attachments? What are the historical binds? Listening to Irish Americans talking about how they bled for America, how Irishmen fought in the Civil War, how they have more Congressional Medals of Honor than anybody else, the heroes in this war and that war, or how they dug canals and built railroads and everything else. And this was a colossal, massive Irish story that, had I stayed in Ireland, I would only be vaguely aware of. But being here, I've become hugely aware of. There are two chapters in the book which I think try to set everything in an historical context. The one concerning Kennedy's funeral, JFK's funeral, Michael McGrath tells his story of being with the Irish Army cadets at the graveside. The chapter about Annie Moore, the rediscovery of Annie Moore, and that day out in Calvary Cemetery in Queens, which was, I mean, much of the work that I do, you'd hardly call emotional, but that just as Kennedy's funeral was emotional that day, I'll never forget it. Roland Tynan nearly knocked the gravestones down at that cemetery when he belted out Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears. And I mean, I kind of consider myself a cynical, hard-nosed reporter, but I was almost choking listening to this and thinking of Annie Moore's story. And of course, she was in Cork, wasn't she? So the Cork connection comes in, or she went through Cork anyway. But those two chapters are, I suppose, designed to underline or explain the reason for the rest of the book. Why this means something. Why Irish America means something. Why the connection between America and Ireland means something historically and in a contemporary sense. Why is it special? Why does it stand out? Why, as Jews ask each other on Passover, why is this night different from other nights? Mm-hmm. Well, why is this story different from other stories? What is it about the Irish in America that is so important that you cannot let it go? You cannot let it just die on the vine and go away, walk into the night. And those two chapters, you know, and it was only kind of when I put them in, I sort of realized, well, geez, that explains a lot to me about why this is such an important story. The fact that the President of the United States would have Irish soldiers, much to the chagrin, mind you, of the Pentagon, would have Irish soldiers standing beside his grave, right beside his grave, and not American soldiers. And that was an extraordinary moment. Absolutely. And most Americans don't know about it. They might look at a photograph and see these two lines of guys from the Curragh camp. As Michael told me, they were all 19-year-old kids. They hear about JFK's. They don't know. They don't know why they're going to America. They don't know. They're woken in the middle of the night. They go to Dublin Airport. There's De Valera. They're getting on an Aer Lingus Boeing 707, and they're flying to America. They have to get their old Lee Enfield rifles out of storage because they just got new, because they just got new Belgian FN automatics, but they didn't work well in the rifle drill. And the boys, they're all on the plane, and they're all worried because none of them had passports. And how are we going to get into America with no passports? And they arrive at Idlewild Airport, soon to be JFK in New York, and there's the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, waiting at the bottom of the steps to welcome them into America in that most awful of moments. This doesn't happen with every country. It just doesn't. You talk about the special relationship with Britain, but nothing like this would happen, really. There is, it's not a military relationship because Ireland is not militarily powerful, but there's something incredibly unique and strong about the bond between a small country on the edge of Europe and the massive country in North America. And those two chapters, I think, kind of try to explain or underpin that in an historical context. And, you know, there's other history as well, obviously, in the book going back and everything else. But those two, for me, were the emotional triggers for much. And there is emotion. I hope there's emotion in this book. I hope readers feel that, you know, this is not just a sort of a narrative, a sort of an A to Z narrative of, well, this happened on this day, and this happened on that day, and this happened on this day. There's a lot more to it than that.
Well, I think, Ray, I think those two chapters, they jumped out at me, and I think you do a great job of combining, contextualizing policy and the implications, but also bringing in those human stories and those stories that reach back into history to explain the present as it was evolving at the time and what that would mean sometimes in ways that we, as you quite rightly say, kind of don't actually fully grasp maybe until later on. To go to the question of, like, how did you write this? You have a busy, you know, job, as, you know, I didn't think about it, you know, now in the digital age, you know, churning out stuff every day. It's like it's a different animal. I've actually never, until you said that, Ray, actually thought about what that means for, you know, a publication like yours in terms of how, and I guess all public, you know, all newspapers in that way to some extent. So how was, is it snippets of time here and there, or do you write in a particular place or at a particular time? Tell me. I'm always fascinated.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a staccato thing. I do write fast. I mean, I've been 43 years in the news business. Funny enough, I read slowly. My wife will read three books in the time I'll read one. And Lisa's now a retired English teacher. So she's a voracious, much more voracious reader. I'm quite a modestly paced reader, but I am, thank God, a very fast writer. But I began around the time of the ILIR years in the noughties, began to sort of think that there's a continuation of what I was writing about the new Irish Americans here. And I started to put stuff together, and a couple of the chapters were kind of basically already written, really, in terms of my reporting. But I suppose it was when I found or was contacted or came across the archive of Judge Collins, and it was being presented with an entirely new story that I was, as I said, only vaguely aware of. And then I saw, oh, wow, there's like one, two, three, A, B, C. There's three parts of the story. There's three organizations over here. This is a broader story now. This is a deeper story. So, I mean, the idea began to form before putting it into writing. You know, the concept for a book here. I did write a few chapters and kind of put them aside because, as you say, there's a lot of stuff going on, so it can be hard. And the kids were younger, and you know, life was crazy, and all the rest of it. So I had a few chapters kind of layaways, but it was in much more recent years that I met Conor Graham, who you know from Merriam Press, Irish Academic Press, and we were at Glucksman Ireland House at a reception, and we got to talk. And I mentioned what I'd started, and I said, you know, I haven't a lot to do, and you know, but there's definitely a story here, Conor. There's a book, right? And we kind of struck a deal, and I wrote it, he published. And once I did that, once I committed, that's like the reporter talking to the editor, and the editor saying, well, you've got to do this story now. And you kind of click into automatic gear in a way. Now I've committed myself. I have this habit of, it's a terrible habit maybe, but I will talk ad nauseum to people. If I have an idea for a book, I'll talk to people about it, and I'll throw out parts of what I'm doing. I'm writing a fiction book right now, and I will talk to people about it. And there's two reactions here. They're going to say, oh my God, he's boring me to death with this book that he may not ever even write. Or, well, that sounds interesting. And what I'm actually doing is I'm gauging reaction. I'm looking at people. I'm looking at their faces. I'm looking at their eyes. I'm listening to their voice. I'm gauging a reaction to an idea that I'm throwing at them. And I'm sort of deciding, well, if they're convinced that this is good, then it's worth doing. And if their eyes glaze over and it isn't good, maybe I should be doing something else. But I actually do this. It's a sampler. It's like an opinion poll almost. And I started to talk to people about the book as well, as I would always do. And I think, as I remember, the reaction was generally, oh yeah, yeah, that's a story that needs to be told. And you don't have to tell me much else beyond that. If you say that's a story that needs to be told, then I'll go off and say, okay, now how am I going to tell it? But it was that night with Conor at Glucksman Ireland House, and I committed myself then. I said, oh God, what have I done? I have to do it now. So I plunged into it and just made the time. You find the time. Mm-hmm. The story is compelling. You somehow find the time. And it wasn't an entirely unfamiliar story to me, but it was blending the chapters together. All the chapters are titles. They're not just numbered. And the titles are supposed to kind of catch the moment, you know, in that particular chapter. So I just started to research and look, and, you know, I had stuff, I had books, I had reports. And of course, it leads you down other paths and you find out other things you didn't know. And in the meantime, the story was in a way still progressing. I hardly use the word progressing, but it was still going on because immigration was cropping up time again. There had been so much more. The night with Schumer, John McCain, of course, came to McLean Avenue. There were lots of dramatic moments and meetings and everything else. And there was the McCain-Kennedy bill. There was the Gang of Eight in 2013, the senators and all the rest of it. So this story was sort of unfolding before my eyes as well. It was presenting itself to me. You couldn't miss it, much of it, in terms of the political debate on Capitol Hill. That was a huge part of the story, and that was happening in real time as well. So you go back to look, do historical research a bit to try and set it all in context as well. So it was kind of swirling around, and I was in the middle of it. And at the end of the day, COVID kind of delayed things a little bit in terms of the publication. It's a good thing because it gave us enough time after the election of Joe Biden to actually mention Joe Biden, rejig the intro slightly, and put him on the cover. So it kind of makes it brings it into the Biden era. And obviously you would think with an Irish American president, there might be some action here, which brings me to the highlight moment of this whole thing. It was May of 2021, the first meeting in the Oval Office between Biden and his Republican colleagues, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi all came. It was the first bipartisan, everybody in the Oval Office meeting, where do we go from here? And Senator Schumer gave President Biden a copy of Unintended Consequences. And it's on the table in front of them. They're all sitting around the Oval Office, and there's the book on the table. I said, oh, my God, you know, wow. Is Joe Biden going to take that to bed and read it at night before he nods up?
Ray, you read my mind, actually, because I wanted to ask you about that, because I saw the Chuck Schumer's blurb and contextualizing all that. I mean, that must have been such a surreal moment for you, wasn't it?
I was so frustrated, because the first photograph was sent to me. Somebody took a photograph of the phone lengthways down the table, and you could see the very end of the book coming out from a pot of flowers, a tiny little blue dot. And I was saying, oh, my God, there's my book. But I have to tell people that that's my book, because it's just a little blue dot. But then other photographs emerged. There's an Associated Press photograph from the side looking over the heads of McConnell and McCarthy, you know, and you see the book in full. There it is on the table. So there it was. I mean, that is the fact that this story has reached into the White House, has been put in the hands of an American president, I think is nothing to do with me or my ego or anything like that. It's for the Irish of America. It's entirely appropriate that an Irish American president, a very Irish American president, mind you, of the United States has this book in his possession. I think it underlines, I suppose, I go back to, this is not just any old story, you know, but any old people, about any old country or any old two countries. I mean, this is a standout story.
Ray, we're coming towards the end of our time, and I thank you for being so generous with your time, and it's lovely to have you on this Irish American Life this week. With all that in mind, how you've had enough time now, and you know, as you mentioned, publishing books, you know, during COVID and everything in some ways has been challenging in terms of, I guess, you know, kind of the traditional ways that we celebrate books. But in other ways, perhaps, you know, I think people have been reading more and everything. You've had enough time now. We often, when I'm interviewing people, it's too close to the publication date to get a sense of like how people have consumed the books or how people have reacted. Have you a sense now of how people have engaged with Unintended Consequences and their thoughts on what you draw out in this very important narrative?
You always look for reviews on Amazon, what people say, and they've been very positive. I will tell you that Marion Press have told me, Irish Academic Press, is that it's the largest selling book they've ever had in America. And I said, that's marvelous. But that's as it should be. This is a book about Ireland, but a book about America and the Irish in America. I try to think sometimes, is it more Irish or more American, and a bit of both and all the rest of it, or it's somewhere in the middle Atlantic. But I think it's a book that will last the test of time, because I do sort of put a ring fence around it at the election of President Biden. It's an historical capsule that in a way will never date. I mean, there will be developments in the overall story, but hopefully it's a book that will last the test of time, and people in 10 years' time will be reading it as much as they are reading it now.
Well, I think, Ray, also, if I may add, I think in a way you were so well placed to write this book. You know, I've made this argument in some of the historical figures that I've looked at, gosh, you know, from 100 years ago and more, about these kind of individuals that, for want of a better term, I use that kind of word broker, people who are from Ireland but are embedded in the American context and see that transatlantic space and the implications of what it can mean politically and culturally in particular, in a particular way. Do you know what I mean, Ray? And in that way, what you're writing about and the implications demographically are actually all the more important, because if we're down to 17 people a year, you know what I mean, coming in, there are going to be fewer and fewer people like you and like me digesting that Irish American interaction in that particular way. So that kind of even longer term historical implications, I think, are even more profound.
Yeah, when you're looking into the crystal ball, I'm looking into the crystal ball and I'm not sure what I'm looking at. It's kind of hazy. It's murky. Very hard. It's easy enough. We can say what has happened up until now and then wonder if what has happened up until now will be the primary cause of what happens next. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Is there anything going to happen next? Is it going to change for the better? I don't know. We're kind of stuck at the moment, I think, for various reasons. As I say, it'll be up to other people in the future. I hope somebody's out there and saying, this is a story that needs to be continued. I don't know if I can do that. It's like all things in life. It's a bit of a mystery. What happens next? And it's not going to happen in a hurry, I don't think. So I think the book kind of ended in the right spot because it wasn't overtaken by events. It's been out for a year and a half now. And nothing dramatic has happened that would say, oh, well, that book really is history now because this has happened. Really nothing has happened. So the book is kind of as relevant today as it was on the day it was published in April 2021.
Yeah, and what you document in that very unique perspective is very, very important, I think, for scholars of the future, Ray, as we digest the implications demographically and the changes and how they will evolve in time. I can't commend this book any more than it's just really great read, such an interesting topic, so well presented, and Ray, you have a lovely, you know, the speed with which you write is matched by your eloquence with the pen, if I can say it that way. The title is Unintended Consequences, The Story of Irish Immigration to the US and How America's Door Was Closed to the Irish. As Ray mentioned, it was published by our great friends at Irish Academic Press, Merrion Press, Conor Graham and his great team there. They always do such a great job. And I'm delighted to hear, and you're right, it's very fitting that this has been their best American seller to date. I hope, Ray, I'll have you back soon to talk about your fiction piece and keep at the day job as well, because I know I enjoy, and I know a lot of our listeners today enjoy what you write all the time there, you and your team at the Irish Echo. We're really just thrilled to have you on today to share the kind of insights into this really, really great book. Thank you so much, Ray. Great to catch up with you, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Mary.
Thanks, Ray.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.